Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Now, the most important part of this dish is not to overcook your oysters. So you want to cook them until what I call they smile, okay? The little edges around the oyster are going to start to wrinkle up and smile at you.
And your guests will smile as well when they try this oyster stew. Chef Daniel Orr makes it sound so easy. We go oyster fishing in the Pearl Lagoon Basin of Nicaragua, where tons and tons of wild oysters are a short paddle away. Then birds. Harvest Public Media looks at the disappearing habitat for Midwestern pheasants. And our resident chicken farmer, Jana Wilson, talks about why she thinks it's important to give her hens a break from laying eggs. Jam-packed show today here on Earth Eats. News this week about milk, but Luann Johnson starts with an update from Congress.
With the deadline on the farm bill looming, lawmakers this week decided to do nothing. Farm bill negotiators said they would not reach a deal before the end of the week when the U.S. House adjourns for the last time in 2013. Negotiators said they were close to a deal and expect a vote in early January. This time, blame old man winter. Stormy weather in the U.S. Capitol stranded a key employee from the Congressional Budget Office, leaving lawmakers without cost estimates they needed to work on a compromise. The country's previous farm legislation expired in September amid an ongoing fight over the future of SNAP benefits and crop insurance. Senate Agriculture Committee Chairwoman Debbie Stabenow told reporters on Tuesday that milk prices would not soar in January as a result of the delay. Without a current farm bill, dairy policy reverts to legislation passed in 1949, a move that could double the cost of milk. But Stabenow said the increase would not take effect next month. Speaking of milk, a report published in PLOS 1 has found evidence that organic milk is higher in omega-3 fatty acids. The nationwide study looked at 384 samples of organic and conventional milk over 18 months. Overall, organic milk contained about 62% more omega-3 fatty acids than conventional milk. Cows that produce milk labeled organic spend some time outside grazing on grass, which is rich in omega-3s, while conventional dairy cows are fed grain-based diets high in omega-6s. Humans need both types of fatty acids, but Americans typically consume far more omega-6s than omega-3s, as much as 25 times more, according to the University of Maryland Medical Center. The study was funded in part by farmers associated with the Cooperative Regions of Organic Producer Pools, which markets Organic Valley. Also this week, Sysco announced it will buy U.S. Foods for $3.5 billion, creating the largest food distributor in the United States. The merger means Sysco will own over a quarter of the market share, with the next largest vendor owning only about 5%. As part of the deal, Sysco will absorb U.S. Foods' debt of $4.7 billion. Sysco provides restaurants, hotels, schools, and hospitals with a broad range of products, including paper goods and perishable and non-perishable food. More about these stories at eartheats.org, and get on Twitter for even more food news, recipes, pictures, and good conversation. We're at Earth Eats.
And we're on Facebook, too. Hope you connect with us. Luann Johnson starts off our show every week. Thanks.
You got it, Annie.
As farmers across the Midwest have simplified the landscape and plowed up grassland to grow more corn and soybeans, habitat for pheasants and other grassland birds like quail and prairie chickens has become increasingly scarce. As Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach reports, changing the prairie is having dire consequences for some of the animals that have long called it home.
This here's our catch barn. All my pens run into this 16-foot alley.
Dustin Chrisman's double-barrel game farm near McCool Junction in eastern Nebraska is a pheasant metropolis. Chrisman raises cattle and corn with his family, but on this farm, he has 15 acres of pheasant pens, each one 700 feet long and 14 feet high, covered with black netting. Roosters cackle and strut with vibrant blue on their heads and white rings on their necks. In Nebraska, wild pheasant concentrations have fallen 86% since their peak in the 1960s. In areas that used to be overrun, you'll struggle to find a pheasant now. But on this farm, Chrisman raises birds in urban densities, nearly 50,000 this year.
Every year we keep adding, you know, pens for another 10,000 to 15,000 birds a year, so hopefully be raising 100,000 in 5 years.
Chrisman sells pheasants across the plains to farmers and private hunting areas.
We go to Wyoming, Colorado, South Dakota, Iowa, Kansas, and Oklahoma.
Like stocking a trout pond, farmed pheasants are used to boost bird numbers for hunting season. That's because across the Midwest, wild populations have been displaced by a landscape that's friendly to farmers, but not pheasants. It's easy to see why if you take a bird's eye view. Larkin Powell, a wildlife biologist at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, sat down with me to look at aerial photographs of a mile section of farmland in central Nebraska. The first photo is from 1938.
We've got a patchwork, you know, 20 or 25 different little squares here.
Each square is a different crop, grass for pasture, oats, wheat, corn. Powell says pheasants thrive in that kind of diverse farm landscape. But over the decades, the land has been simplified for irrigation and farming efficiency. Fewer crops cover more space, pushing habitat to the margins. We looked at the same land in 2010, and it was mostly three big fields of corn or soybeans.
You can see the tracks of at least three center pivots here. So three-fourths of that square mile are now completely all a single crop. The fence rows are essentially gone from those areas, and we're really going from road to road.
As fields expand, there's less room for pheasants to roam. Even land once set aside for habitat is being converted for farming. The number of acres in the Federal Conservation Reserve Program, or CRP, has shrunk by more than 300,000 acres in Nebraska in the last 5 years. Farmer Chad Rathman has noticed the trends.
When I was a kid growing up, you could walk any fence row within a mile of my place and kick out a pheasant, but you don't see them anymore.
Rathman farms about 1,000 acres of seed corn and soybeans near Wood River in central Nebraska. He also hunts deer, turkeys, and pheasants. He says farmers are trying to get more from the land they have, and they are. In the time pheasants have been declining, Nebraska farmers are growing 400% more corn on 80% more land. Farmers have taken land out of CRP, and the government is allowing less land in the program.
The government's cut them CRP acres. When you start cutting up and the price of corn is what it is, yeah, economically, the guys are not going to leave it in the CRP. I mean, it ain't doing it to hurt the pheasant population or anything. It's just economical.
Ben Wheeler of the hunting conservation group Nebraska Pheasants Forever stands on a dirt road looking at a cornfield in rural Valley County. Just over a year ago, it was a hilly grass pasture. Then it was plowed up, filled in, and put under center pivot irrigation.
It's not uncommon around here for native grass to be turned over into cropland. And if this continues, it's a little bit difficult to imagine what this place is going to look like in 20 years from now.
Wheeler says it's not just the pheasants that are missing, it's the hunters who fill rural hotels and restaurants this time of year. A survey from U.S. Fish and Wildlife shows each pheasant harvested is worth $93 to the Nebraska economy. The pheasant harvest over the last decade was about half what it was as recently as the 90s.
A lot of folks have given up hunting altogether as a product of law of diminishing returns. And so if we want to have pheasants out there, quail out there, prairie chickens, we're going to have to find a way to work habitat into the fabric of our agricultural landscape.
The decisions farmers and other landowners make will tip the balance when it comes to wildlife habitat. The way things are going, it's hard for conservation to keep up with cultivation. I'm Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media at harvestpublicmedia.org. Vicki Bassman was here last week talking about her adventures in the Pearl Lagoon Basin of Nicaragua. Her new cookbook is a compilation of traditional recipes using local foods, which for this area of the world is coconut and lots of fresh seafood. There are some foods in here that I didn't know. Introduce me to karkle.
Karkle. We went karkle gathering with Miss Marjorie, who is a Miskito woman. And what we did was we went out into the lagoon, and the lagoon waters are what you would imagine from a lagoon. They're not crystal clear. They're brackish. And so she carried a bucket on her head, and we walked out barefoot into the lagoon and would squeeze the sand with our toes. And when you felt a shell, you brought it up with your toes, and then if it was karkel, you put it in the bucket that she had on her head. So the entire day of karkel gathering, I kept thinking, why do they call these karkel? And it really wasn't until I came home and did some research that I realized that that was their Creole language for cockles, which is British. And the Creole language is British-based. So a lot of British words seep into their language. And cockles are mussels. So if you want to create the karkel recipe, you just get yourself some mussels. That's all it is.
Okay. With your toes in the sand?
Right. So, because for one, that allows you to stay upright and keep the bucket on your head. But it really works. And you can, and she did find probably three cockles to Emma, my daughter, and I finding one. And at one point she laughed and said, maybe they have an aversion to white feet in the sand.
I also want you to introduce us to Mr. Orlando Forbes. And listeners will notice that we're using titles. That's also something they do in the Pearl Lagoon. You went oyster fishing with him. Tell us about that experience.
And the titles is also a Creole, something that's hung on through their British days. So Mr. Orlando was from the neighboring town of Awas, which is a Miskito community, as was Miss Marjorie, who took us karkel hunting. We asked him if he could take us and show us a recipe, and he offered to take us oyster hunting. So he borrowed his uncle's canoe, and the canoes there are all dugout canoes. And he brought along his son. So we paddled for well over an hour. And he finally pulled off onto one little island in the lagoon, and he and Seth jumped out and just started reaching down and pulling up these amazing oysters. And I kept thinking how here we pay top dollar for oysters, and it's a treat to go out and get oysters. And here they were just pulling them up and tossing them in the boat. And every now and then he'd get his machete and open one and just slide one down, you know.
Whoa.
Right? It, like we might eat persimmons that we pick from the tree.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets back in the boat, and we start paddling again. And Emma and I, of course, thought we were headed back. But lo and behold, we pulled up to another island. And he and Seth both jumped out of the boat and went into the interior of the island and disappeared. They came back after a while with armloads of coconuts, and they had both the brown coconuts, which are the ones that you use for the cooking, and they had green ones, underripe ones, which have the watery coconut milk that's such a refreshing thing to drink. And they had brought those so that all four of us would have something fresh to drink. And then the long journey back to Awas, and once we got to Awas, he went right to work. Opened up the oysters, they grated the coconut, they had some other vegetables and things, and threw together oyster stew. It was delicious.
This recipe is included in Vicki Bassman's book, Pearls from the Lagoon, co-sponsored by the U.S. Forest Service, the International Institute for Tropical Forestry, and the U.S. Agency for International Development. All proceeds go to the people of Pearl Lagoon. Find information on how to order the book on Facebook. Search for Pearls from the Lagoon. That recipe for Mr. Orlando's oyster stew is at eartheats.org. Chef Daniel Orr has his own recipe. No coconut in this one, but plenty of heavy cream.
So today we're going to make an oyster stew, and it's a great dish to celebrate with. And another great thing about it is that it's so easy and so quick. What we're going to start with are the leeks. Now, if you aren't familiar with leeks, it's in the member of the allium family, which is the onion family. And it looks like a big scallion. But there is something that you have to worry about is that it can be very sandy. They're planted in very sandy soil. So what you want to do is just to kind of cut off the very end, the root end, but you still leave the base attached a little bit. That will hold the leek together. Then what we're going to do is make a long cut down the middle. but not all the way through. So we can kind of open it up, and you'll see all those different layers of the leak in there. What we're going to do is we're going to take this over to the sink, and then just with some high-pressured water, just rinse it out really well. Now, the outer leaves of the leek, the real dark green ones, they can tend to be a little bit tougher. So just set these aside and use those in your vegetable stock or your chicken stock or if you want to make a potato leek soup. But we want the real tender, light green and white part of the leek for this stew. Okay, I'm just going to cut it in about a quarter inch dice. Okay, you do eat with your eyes and you always want to have some appealing colors. You know, you don't want to have a dish that's white on white on white, which this kind of would be with the oysters and the cream and the celery. So you want a little bit of that green from the leek on the top there. Okay, and now we're just going to wash this again, and then we're ready to go. Okay, next I've got my pan on the fire. I'm just going to chop up some garlic quickly. Okay, I'm going to add some butter to my pan. You really want to hear that sizzle, but you don't want the butter to really brown. Okay, I'm going to quickly add these leeks. And it's okay to have a little bit of that water go in there because that will prevent them from browning. Okay, we're going to add that finely minced celery. Now, I want to have these veggies a little bit toothsome, and that will be a nice textural contrast to the oysters. All right, now we're just going to add our seasonings. One of my favorites, again, some lemon zest. And again, lemon zest adds that wonderful citrus flavor through its essential oils without adding a lot of acid. You really don't want, especially something real creamy, you don't want to have a lot of acid in it or it can curdle. Okay, I'm going to add a little bit of cayenne pepper for our heat, a little bit of the Kitchen Dior New Regime blend. I'm going to add a couple sprigs of thyme. And now what we're going to do is just add our half and half. Now, I said this was an easy recipe, but it's also a rich one. Once this comes to a boil, we add the oysters. We don't want to cook it much once we add the oysters, though they'll become tough. In the meantime, I've toasted some nice baguette bread, and I've pre-warmed our bowls. So once this is done, we're going to be able to go straight to the table, which is very important. All right, it's come to a full boil. I'm going to add the oysters with the liquor. The liquor is the juice that is from the oysters. Again, you don't want to oversalt your stew because you're going to be adding the oysters to it, and they tend to have a little bit of that saline flavor from the ocean. Now, the most important part of this dish is not to overcook your oysters. So you want to cook them until what I call they smile, okay? The little edges around the oyster are going to start to wrinkle up and smile at you, and we are there.
We still have a couple months with an R ahead of us, so make this stew and let us know how you like it. Send us a note to eartheats@gmail.com. Coming up, give your chickens a break.
There's a reason that the hens stop laying. The energy that they get, the food goes toward producing new feathers for the following year, and that protects their body from the cold for the winter. So I believe in giving my hens a break.
Jana Wilson's chickens aren't laying eggs right now. Find out what she did in the early fall to prepare for these lean months. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all four locations and a garden center at East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage and hatha yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at TouchstoneWellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Okay. So the whole thing, it came up in one of my Facebook groups because somebody was saying, oh, yeah, you know, I've had two flocks of chickens and my hens have crowed. And somebody said, yeah, I've had hens crow. And I'm like,
wouldn't you call that a rooster?
No, these are hens. They laid eggs and then they've stopped laying and they start crowing.
Well, somebody said, Jenna Wilson did a little research and she found the answer. Just a moment and she'll tell us. Chicken farmers like Jenna do love to talk, and especially to one another. We're referencing some questions broached on several of the Facebook groups she's a part of for today's conversation. Even if you're not a chicken person, this is interesting stuff. So, okay, back to the hens that crow.
Hens lay on their from their left ovary, and if it gets damaged, they switch to their right ovary, but there's a higher level of testosterone. It's female testosterone. And that's what causes the sex change. And they get bigger wattles, bigger combs, and they start crowing.
Whoa. Well, they'll stop laying eggs.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So in the city, you can't have noisy chickens. What do you do?
I don't know what you do. I don't know what you do. I think you have to decide if your neighbors are going to be upset if the hen's crowing. Because technically, legally, you can have a hen, whether she crows or not. So isn't that funny?
That is so you learned that just for this because of that question?
Yeah.
So why do people get chickens for eggs? So let's talk eggs. It's the wintertime. So have your birds just totally stopped?
Yes.
Because it's just too cold?
No, actually, this is interesting. The cold has very little to do with it. The reason hens stop laying in the fall, late fall and winter, is light. The hens need at least, I think it's like 16 hours of continual light a day. And that triggers in their brain the process that will start egg laying. So as the days get shorter, hens will stop laying.
Could you manufacture laying time for them if you have some sort of heat lamp or sun lamp in their coop?
Yes, you can add light, and people do that. It doesn't have to be a bright light. The saying goes that a lot of people say if you have a light bulb that is bright enough to read a newspaper by, that's enough light to trigger. And you can put it on a timer. It's better if they get their 16 hours. It's better if it starts earlier in the morning rather than having the light go till 10 at night or something because it helps regulate their system. And so some people do that. And that way they will get eggs throughout the winter.
You don't do that, right?
No, I don't.
Why don't you do that?
Well, I believe in – first of all, there's a purpose. There's a reason that the hens stop laying. It does have to do with light. But in the fall, the hens also do something called a molt. And a molt is when their old, broken, ragged feathers fall out. And for a while, they look – some hens look almost completely naked. And it's not a pretty sight to see a naked chicken, let me tell you. But their feathers fall out and new ones grow in. And I really like to give the hens a break. Their bodies, the energy that they get, the food goes toward producing new feathers for the following year, and that protects their body from the cold for the winter. So I believe in giving my hens a break. But I understand if someone has a small flock, it's distressing. Mm-hmm. I don't have any eggs, but I don't know. At our house, we just eat fewer eggs.
Well, have you been hoarding your eggs?
Well,
through the summer?
Here's what I do. In the summer or late summer, early fall, when you have just a ton of eggs and you don't know what to do with them all and you're giving them to people, what you can do is you can take a few eggs and you can beat them very gently and pour them into a freezer container and freeze them. Sometimes I take ice cube trays and I beat up an egg just slightly and then I put it in individual ice cube containers, freeze them, pop them out, and I have a baggie full of frozen eggs.
I love that.
So, yeah. And then occasionally I do break down around the holidays and I will go to the store and buy – I will buy eggs, but I will only buy local farm eggs. So it's very important to me.
As close as your birds as can be? Is that what you're thinking?
Absolutely. Yeah. I will buy eggs in which the farmer's name is imprinted on the label so I know where they came from. So I don't do it often, but I do it sometimes.
Jenna Wilson sharing her knowledge of chickens and eggs and all things in between. She's written a bunch of posts on our website for your reading pleasure. She'll be back next week to talk about keeping your birds happy and healthy during the cold months. In the kitchen again, this recipe is for anyone out there who's been assigned to bring drinks to the annual holiday party. Chef Daniel Orr calls it his shake-up cocktail. It's a simple premise. Fill some ball jars with fresh ingredients and local spirits, screw the lids on, and let the revelers do the mixing. It's like giving everyone their own cocktail shaker.
I'm going to do kind of a fall-winter shake-up today. I've got some fresh cranberries that I've chopped in the food processor. Then I've got the one piece of orange peel, orange zest, that you can take off with a vegetable peeler. Drop that in there. Then I've got some fresh basil out of my garden, and we're just going to kind of crunch that up a little bit, bring out those essential oils. So to this, we're going to add some of our local applejack, because it's going to be kind of a cranberry apple martini. Then we've got some really nice Clément Creole shrub rub rum. So that's a orange rum, but you could use Grand Marnier or Triple Sec. We're going to add a half jigger of lemon juice, and I'm going to actually put a little slice of lime inside, and then we're going to top it off with a full jigger and a half of apple cider. And then what you can do is have these all measured out ahead of time in your refrigerator, and then when your guests get here, you fill it up about with ice until it's about 3/4 of the way full. Then you put the lid on, you give it a good shake.
Like your own personal shaker.
Yeah. And then we're going to just put a little fizz on it with some club soda. Give it a stir. And you've got a wonderful winter cranberry and orange shake-up with fresh apple cider. Cheers, everybody. Enjoy.
The coolest thing about this drink, I think, is the ball jar. Save your fancy stemware for another party. I just love how homey the ball jars make everything feel. Put pictures with the sounds, see the recipe and the man behind the bar, all at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Vicky Bassman, Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Jana Wilson, and the entire team at Harvest Public Media. Today, we're wishing a fond farewell to Ben Alford, who worked as our online content coordinator. He's off to other opportunities, sure to see big things from him in the future. Thanks for all the hard work over the years, Ben. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all 4 locations and a garden center at East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage and hatha yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at TouchstoneWellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Hope your holiday season is full of fun, friends, and, of course, food. Lots and lots of tasty food. This is Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for listening.